Creating the City of the Future, a new exhibit on Alexander Hamilton, and an opera about the feminist artist, Frida. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. National Geographic has a new series about how city planners from around the world are trying to design a sustainable city of the future. Also, speaking of sustainability, the University of Miami is now offering a master's on the topic, and we'll hear from the dean. And you may have seen the Broadway show Hamilton, but there's another show on display at NSU that looks at the role Hamilton played in creating our country. We'll learn more about the exhibit and some of the conversations that are scheduled over the next few weeks. Finally, Florida's Grand Opera is bringing the story of the Mexican artist Frida to the stage. Our producer, Alejandro Martinez, talks with the star of the show about portraying such a controversial and inspirational character. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, South Floridians spend a lot of time in their cars. On average, last year, Miamians spent a total of 3 days in traffic. You may be stuck in traffic right now listening to this program. We'll try to get you through it. As we continue building out our cities, how should we be thinking about the way we design them? The newest special April edition of National Geographic is exploring the urban design plan for cities of the future. It's entitled Rethinking Cities. Senior Environment Editor for National Geographic, Rob Kunzig, traveled to cities around the world and examined some of the innovative projects that are getting more people out of their cars. He's joining us now from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Mr. Kunzig, thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Your piece looks at one of the fundamental problems in some of the biggest cities in the world, including Miami, which is urban sprawl. First of all, let's redefine that again. What is urban sprawl?
Urban sprawl is the designer Peter Calthorpe calls a disconnected environment. So the kind of urban sprawl we have in the United States it's very familiar. It's what you were just talking about. It's a landscape built around the automobile. So it's a landscape where to get to work, to get to shopping, to get to school, to get home, you are driving on highways, you are parking in vast parking lots, and so on. But it's sprawl exists in different forms too. And so one of the interesting things I discovered is when I went to China that they have their own form of it, and it's more of a high rise kind of sprawl. But it's tall cookie cutter apartment buildings on broad highways that are just as hard to walk on as our strips, and where people are just as disconnected from each other as they are in a suburban landscape.
So it's this idea of having to depend on the car, but also the fact that it disconnects us from each other. And you talk about, you know, Peter Calthorpe, you know, he is one of these urban designers leading this movement to create cities for humans and not for the car. But what's the bigger picture for him? What does he see?
Well, I think the bigger picture is we have in this, and this is what motivated me when I was asked to write an article on cities of the future. And what I decided very early on was that, you know, for very few of us is it going to be a city built from scratch, you know, some utopia in the desert or something. It's we have existing cities and we have this legacy of the 20th century that we're building on. And so Peter Calthorpe has been working hard, and he's part of this movement called the New Urbanism, which there's some very prominent exponents of in Miami, by the way. The DPZ firm is a leader of it. They're working on efforts to deal with that legacy. And so the vision is, can you fill in the sprawl? Can you reconnect the extended city with transit, with public transit? Can you make neighborhoods that are walkable again, where people can walk to work, walk to school, walk to shopping? And can you basically not to eliminate the car, but to reduce our utter reliance on it in most American cities.
And you talk about this group, this Congress for New Urbanism. What are the fundamental tenets of this group?
Well, the CNU began, and it was founded by Peter Calthorpe and by Andres Duany and Elizabeth Plater Zyberg, who are in Miami, and some other people too. And initially, it began, I think, mostly as a movement back towards traditional neighborhoods. But it soon developed into a broader vision of what I was just describing, essentially, of a more connected environment, and essentially an environment of having modern cities that had some of the advantages of the old ones. If you look back in history, a lot of what we did to cities in the 20th century was a reaction to cities that were sort of crowded, dense, dirty, polluted in the 19th century. We were basically trying to flee them, and the car helped us do that. But we no longer need to do that. And those cities of the 19th century had lots of advantages. They had this walkability. They had this charm. They had they were just more. Once you cleaned up the pollution, they were more healthy and humane environments. And so the CNU is basically about restoring and modernizing what's best about an older vision of cities.
Now, you looked at cities all around the world, and I'm wondering, first of all, how did you pick those cities? What was unique about those cities?
Well, I wanted to do. I'm American, and I wanted to write about the American situation. But its sprawl is a global problem, and I didn't think you could write. And urbanization is a global problem, and what is. I didn't think you could write about the future of cities without going to China, just because there's so many. I mean, the Chinese have moved 500 million people in cities in the last few decades, and they're expected to move another 300 million in the next decade or two. So I felt I needed to see what they were doing. So that's basically how I did it. And then I traveled a little bit in Europe as well, which I know better. China was new to me, so that was quite an experience.
Can we compare, you know, what Chinese cities are doing, what China's doing with its cities and dealing with this issue, dealing with the pollution, the cars, a very big population, and you know, again, trying to move people back into certain centers. Can we compare what they're doing to what we need to do here in the United States?
Well, there are similarities. It's not the same. The Chinese never developed in any great way. They urbanized much faster than we did. They did everything faster than we did. Their population boom was faster. Their urbanization boom was faster. And they had many more people to house, and they had an urgent poverty problem that they were addressing with urbanization. So they never really developed the kind of, you know, single family home suburbs to anything like the extent we did, and that's pretty much stopped. So it's really an apartment building culture. But as I was saying before, they did it in a way that was heavily reliant on a vision that they inherited from the West, and to some extent also from the Soviet Union. And it was this isolating vision of, you know, identical apartment buildings in rows. It's the cheapest way to build, and giant streets, because that's how they thought people were going to move. And now they're sort of stuck with it. So they too, they're shifting. What I discovered when I went to China is that the urban planning movement there is really undergoing a big change. They've recognized the error, but they like us, they have a legacy of what they've done over just the past few decades to deal with. And they're trying to change it by adding transit, by where they're building new neighborhoods, by not building the streets so wide. It's as simple as that. By putting shops and offices and homes in the same neighborhood.
It's rethinking the whole cityscape. It's how we've been building out our cities, because we've been building around roads. Again, talking with Rob Kunzig, Senior Environment Editor for National Geographic, the author behind one of the lead stories in the newest edition of Nat Geo entitled Rethinking Cities. Again, thinking about the city of the future. We can't build a whole new city. We have to rethink how we are looking at our city now. And he's joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Let's look at some American cities, Rob. Let's look at, for example, Atlanta as one of them. And we hear about this all the time. We hear about Atlanta, a southern city that's grown very fast over the last decade, and how they're trying to rethink their roads, but getting people to start walking more and getting people more connected. One of the things they did was the Beltline.
Yeah, that's right. And Atlanta is one of the most sprawling cities on Earth. And it's really hard to see how that's going to change very fast, because it's just so spread out. But the city the metropolitan area, that is. But the city itself does have this inspiring project, the Beltline, which is they had a loop of abandoned rail lines, 22 miles long, that sort of goes around the city of Atlanta. And they decided, mostly under the drive of this one young urban planner, Ryan Gravel, to convert that to first to a walking and biking trail. And ultimately, the vision is to put streetcars, at least on part, and Gravel would recommend putting it on the whole 22 miles. Right now, what they've done is they've converted about a third of that in several segments. And it's already having a big economic impact where they did it. I mean, I walked along the part on the east side. It's led to a big development of apartment buildings and retail markets like the Ponce City Market.
And you know, there's something interesting about that is so there's a project here in Miami called the Underline, and it's underway now. And it's this idea of underneath the metro rail line, which is elevated, to build these small parks, better pathways for pedestrians and cyclists, to build these spaces where people can come, sort of like the Beltline. But, I mean, you're telling me the Beltline is working. So, I mean, it's just something that we can look at and say, this could work.
Yeah, it is working. And I would say at the moment, the Beltline is more of a lifestyle thing. It's more of a recreational trail than a transit trail. But it could also become a transit trail. And I don't know whether in Miami, whether a bike trail along the lines of the Underline, whether that you might see bikes actually replacing, you know, becoming a more significant transit option for some trips. But I think it's also important just to realize how inspiring something like this can be. It's just a nice place. I mean, picture a basically an abandoned space that no one goes to. It's maybe even a little bit scary, like this old line that's, you know, fenced off from neighborhoods and you can't get at, full of trash. And now you convert it to a sort of a linear park that people are biking and walking under. It's uplifting. That's a really important effect of it, too.
You talk about uplifting, but I'm wondering, is that enough to get people out of their cars? And let's look at L.A. as another example, urban sprawl, you know, traffic congestion, housing affordability. What are they doing in L.A.? Because it's uplifting, yes, but how do we convince people of the alternative?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And no, the Beltline is not getting Atlanta people out of their cars in any significant numbers. It's not really able to do that yet. L.A. is doing something a little bit more robust along those lines. It's going through a big expansion of the metro. The citizens there have, with two-thirds majorities, twice raised their sales tax to finance transit expansion. So they're extending this. They have a subway, which a lot of people probably don't even know. We think of it as the car city, but they're extending their purple subway line. They've put a light rail line to Santa Monica, about 15 miles from downtown. They're building a light rail line to the airport. But as you suggest, it's not easy. Transit alone will not reverse what's happened to the cities, because you need people living near the transit so they can get to it easily. And you need to make driving more less convenient and more expensive than transit.
And something interesting you point out in the story is that we've seen a decline in public transit use. This has been an issue here. We've talked about it on the program, where we've seen the use of metro rail and the buses decline. What have you seen around the world that gets people to want to ride?
Better transit. And the decline, Miami is, you know, you're not alone. The decline is in the U.S. The decline in transit ridership is nationwide. About 32 out of 35 major cities, I think, have experienced substantial decline in transit in the last 5 years. And it has to do simply with the fact that there's an economic boom. That at first it has to do with the fact that our cars are built to get around in our cities are built to get around by car, and that driving has become cheap because with an economic boom, we can afford cars better, and gas is relatively cheap, and Uber and Lyft have become available, that kind of thing.
So
the way to respond to that is to make, you have to make transit more attractive. You can't, the worst thing you can do is to pull back from transit and let it go into death spiral. You have to invest in it and make it faster and more convenient than driving.
I can't let you go without asking about this because you mentioned Uber and Lyft. So I'm wondering what these, you know, because they're heading in the direction of self-driving cars and we're heading in the direction of self-driving cars. But the role that's going to play in the future. And you also brought up in the story, and I thought it was interesting and it seemed kind of right out of the Jetsons, flying cars.
Yes, flying cars. I'm so glad you asked about that. Yeah, the self-driving technology or self-flying technology is the next big thing, and there's no question it's going to have a big impact on cities. And most of the planners I talked to, I'd say, are a little bit terrified of it because they think self-driving cars is just going to be sprawl on steroids, is what
right.
they would say. You know, when you've got basically a living room, a robotic living room driving you to the office, I mean, why not? Why not commute for an hour? But the self-flying planes is, you know, would be even worse, even though they would be incredibly cool. I mean, I would love to take one myself, frankly. But I think the more interesting vision is not to say that this technology is bad, but how can we use it in a way that really helps cities? And there is self-driving public transit is a real option. And that's what this guy, Peter Calthorpe, that I spent a lot of time with, is pushing. You take one of these commercial strips that are all over America. You build housing, especially in a place like Silicon Valley where it's in such short supply. You build housing on sort of five-story buildings, but dense enough. And you put autonomous minibuses along a dedicated lane down the center of what had been this strip boulevard. And these things can be steered by app. You can
right,
go
right.
quickly to destinations. Suddenly you have a sort of a form of urbanism that sort of reconciles the best of the old with the best of the new.
It's a fascinating story. It makes you think about how our cities in South Florida are built and how can we build them for the future. Rob Kunzig, again, Senior Environment Editor for National Geographic. That new series is called Rethinking Cities. He's joined us from the studios, NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Rob, it's a great series. Thank you so much for sharing. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And again, check it out. Just makes you think. How can we rethink our cities? All right, still to come, maybe you're interested in creating that city of the future. The University of Miami has a new degree in sustainability. We're going to hear from the dean next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, South Florida remains one of the most vulnerable regions to sea level rise and climate change nationwide. Businesses are continuing to adapt to the changing climate. They're updating their practices to become more eco-friendly. The University of Miami Business School wants to train the next generation of leaders in this field. This fall, they're launching the first class of its Sustainable Business Master's Program. It's the first STEM-certified Sustainable Business Master's Program of its kind. And applications for the program for this fall are due April 1st. We talk with John Quelch, Dean of the University of Miami's Business School, about what makes the program unique and what opportunities are available for new graduates. Sustainability practice is not new in business or in government. I mean, go back to the 70s and we had solar panels on the White House at one point. Why do you think it's taken educational institutions this long to create those programs and the pipelines into this type of work?
I think two reasons. Number one, that up to now, the educational institutions have been looking at this, but really as an add-on to individual curricula, whether it be in architecture, in business, in engineering. There's been a sustainability course in each of these curricula. What there hasn't been is really a fully integrated program that bridges interdisciplinary-wise across multiple programs that build in the total holistic view that's necessary for a true sustainability approach to take hold in a company or in a government organization or an NGO.
So this master's program now at the University of Miami, what is it going to entail? What are the students going to be learning?
What we're doing is something quite different from the few other programs that already exist. We're combining science with business. We're combining the theory with practice. How are we doing that? What we're doing is we're taking courses from the architecture and civil engineering departments and putting those in combination with practical business courses that look at green finance or look at sustainability in marketing, that look at overall enterprise sustainability.
I'm a student interested. Do I have to have background in science, in chemistry, things like that?
No, you do not. What we're looking for are around about, for the inaugural class starting in August, looking for around about 30 to 35 very passionate but also very academically qualified individual students who are going to be coming from all fields. But if they have the chutzpah and the academic credentials, they're going to be able to take this combination of science, engineering, and business courses to come out with a degree that's going to position them to become someone on track to be the chief sustainability officer of a Fortune 500 company.
Do you have any companies or organizations in South Florida that are going to be partnering?
Yes, we do. We have an advisory board already set up for the degree program. Several of the companies represented on that board would include Royal Caribbean, would include EY, otherwise known as Ernst & Young, would include JM Family, the auto distributor. So from a range of different businesses, we've been able to draw on the talent pool of management that exists already in our region to advise us on curriculum design and to provide the capstone projects that are essential to the students who are taking the course.
And you had mentioned that there are other schools giving sustainability-type courses. I mean, you have Tulane, USF, UF, have some sort of master's in sustainability. What makes this one different?
There are two things that make it different. Number one, you know, more than any other city in the United States, we have the authority and the right to make a point on this issue because of the ocean rise and the existential threat. But secondly, and more importantly, Tulane, those other programs you mentioned, they do not have a Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. And it's the adjacency of that school with our business school that enables us, I think, in combination with architecture and engineering, to offer something that is truly unique. This particular MS in Sustainable Business will be the first STEM-certified degree of that nature in the United States.
I'm talking with John Quelch, Dean, Miami School of Business. The university right now is offering the first STEM-certified Master's in Sustainable Business in the country. For the fall of 2019, they are accepting applications now. You know, South Florida businesses are already facing, we're all facing this issue, the harsh reality of climate change and sea level rise, the intensification of storms and weather patterns, and king tides especially. How much of the environmental reality that we're experiencing right now is going to be incorporated into those classes?
A very substantial amount because, number one, we want to be locally relevant. And the majority of our graduates, I'm sure, will want to stay and work in South Florida or in Florida more generally if they can. And secondly, in addition to that, we have this unique combination of assets in terms of the Rosenstiel School, the Business School, and the Architecture and Engineering operations.
So I think of myself as a student, and if I'm considering this kind of program, I'm wondering, what are the industries right now in South Florida that are putting sustainability at the front and that these could be potential employers?
Well, certainly you would have to look at utilities. You would have to look at government agencies that are dealing with water management, that are dealing with transportation and traffic flow. You would have to look at the leisure and travel industry sector. Obviously, the cruise ship industry is an enormous consumer of energy, for example. And remember, when we're talking about sustainability, we're not just talking about environmental sustainability. These days, we're also talking about human capital and the sustainability and quality of the workforce for long-term productivity.
And that was John Quelch, Dean of the University of Miami's Business School. You can find more information about the University of Miami's Master's in Sustainable Business on our social media. The deadline, again, to apply is April 1st. All right, still to come, if you fell in love with Alexander Hamilton after watching the Broadway show, there's another show, an exhibit you got to check out. We'll talk about that coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Maybe you've seen the Broadway musical Hamilton from Lin-Manuel Miranda. What's he gonna do in the bench? I mean, Hamilton. No one has my resilience or matches my practical tactical brilliance. Hamilton. You want to fight for your land back? Hamilton. I need my right-hand man back. Get your right-hand man back. The success of the show has definitely given Hamilton a whole new level of celebrity. But what do you know about one of the most important people in the history of this nation? There's an exhibit and a series of talks about Hamilton going on now at the Cotilla Gallery at Nova Southeastern University, and it runs through April 15th, Tax Day, of all things. We're joined now by Adam Levinson. He's the curator of the exhibition and behind the historical blog Statues and Stories. Adam, great to have you here.
It is my great pleasure.
And also joining us is David Wells Roth, a contemporary painter who painted a number of pieces of Hamilton and other forefathers, including the exhibition that's going to be at the exhibition. David, great to have you.
Thank you.
And go ahead. You wanted to tell me something.
Yes, actually, I did not paint Hamilton.
It wasn't Hamilton.
It was Isaiah Thomas, publisher, printer.
Who is connected to Hamilton.
Correct.
You're going to tell
yes.
us how in a little
sure.
bit. Adam, I want to start with you. What's your fascination with Hamilton? Because you've been into Hamilton way before there was a Broadway show.
So how much time do we have?
Not that much.
Let me begin by saying this is the room where it happens at WLRN, and I'm shaking in my boots to be here. But when people go into this exhibit, and I'll get to your question in a second, when you see what we have, Alexander Hamilton's actual book, everyone will experience the amazement and the feelings that are phenomenal. But what brought my attention to Hamilton, I've been collecting law books for, and when I say law books, people sort of roll their eyes, but these are antiquarian legal texts, and we have in this collection that people are going to get to see the Acts of the First Congress, the Tea Act, the Stamp Act. And to answer your question, as a lawyer, that's what I do by day. I'm a lawyer. And nights and weekends, I'm a history blogger. So I use these old law books to teach American history. And now teachers and professors are starting to use this website as a source of primary sources and information.
Take us in. We walk in. We're going to see this exhibit. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to see.
When you first walk in, and I want to make the connection to Hamilton and Isaiah Thomas, you're going to see the British Acts of Parliament. You're going to see continental currency. In fact, I'm handing you
a
farthing,
which is
a coin. And when people come to the exhibit, they can read about what a farthing is, but it has Rex George III on it. And this coin may have been held by Alexander Hamilton. But Hamilton, a lot of historians all agree, was the foremost pamphleteer in American history. He is the voice in many ways of the Revolution and at all critical moments of American history. But that voice, and he's referred to as a human word machine, Alexander Hamilton, and pamphleteer, etc. But without a medium, without newspapers who are willing to print what he's saying, yeah. And that gets to Isaiah Thomas. So what you first see are these Acts of Parliament, continental currency. We have a $3 continental dollar bill from the United Colonies. But Isaiah Thomas and David, that's where he comes in. We had to give justice to these primary sources and books, and David's artwork.
And I wanted to give that back to you because I'm glad that I got to touch it. Maybe I got to touch something that Alexander Hamilton touched. But real quickly, just the other thing, and David, before I get to you, is, you saw the show. And I just chatted with you a second ago, and I said, you know what, look, I mean, and I remember, I was a history major in college, so I remember so much about the forefathers of the nation. But before the show, if I had gone and asked 10 people on the street, name two or three of the most significant people who created our nation, maybe they don't mention his name, even though he's on the $10 bill. After the show, I'm willing to bet that they would mention his name because of the popularity of the show. Your thoughts about that? What do you think about that?
There is no question Alexander Hamilton is trending. And for many years, he was the forgotten founding father. And until Lin-Manuel Miranda, who, by the way, is a genius, I am a big fan, almost as much as I am of Luis Fernandez. But long story short, so I agree with you that because of that show, which has my daughters, I learned about some of the songs. They were walking around the house singing it. They learned this in elementary school with their history teacher.
He did that. He brought back this our attention to someone so important. David, I wanted to come to you. So, I mean, you talk about this exhibit. This, by the way, the exhibit is a collection of, again, some of the important papers that Hamilton has written, but it's also got artwork, and there are a number of conversations, one of which you're going to be hosting coming up this weekend, I want you to tell us about. But going back, you had a series of paintings you created, mm-hmm. And again, focusing on this gentleman, Isaiah Thomas, and this was between 95 and 97 you created these paintings. Real quickly, just tell us about those paintings and how you were chosen to do them.
I was chosen because my style of painting can mimic or resemble classical work of the 1800s, the 1700s. And so I was able to basically fulfill the need for replacing art that they already had at the Union Oyster House restaurant. So they gave me sort of vague subject matter to paint, but I researched for about a year and a half before I even started painting and started to understand what the scenes of Boston might have looked like at the time, and I was able to apply it to Isaiah Thomas's world. So I started to develop the painting based on that research, and so the paintings are of Isaiah Thomas during the time that he was a Revolutionary War publisher in Boston during 1770 through 1775.
And what do you the talk that's coming up is on Sunday.
It's on Sunday at 2:00 p.m. at the Cotilla Gallery.
And a little bit about what you're going to be sharing.
I'll be my posters are up on the wall, which are comprised of my paintings and explanations of the paintings, and then explanations on how I made the paintings and what kind of research I had to do to get the painting.
What did you find most fascinating in your research about that pre-colonial era? Well, no, the colonial era, excuse me, the pre, Constitution era, before the Revolutionary War. What did you gather in your research that you didn't already know?
That's an interesting question. I found that there was tension and stress during this time of the colonies, and I tried to captivate that sensation, that feeling, and a couple of my paintings deal with the rush away from the British, to try to escape from the British, and how Isaiah Thomas was confronting the British. There's one painting called Anyway, he's dealing with being almost arrested for having written a very seditious article, and his studio is called a Sedition Foundry.
This is the one where two British soldiers are in the room, and they're
challenging freedom of speech. That's right. They're in the room. They're about to arrest him, and this is an imagined scene based on the research that I had done.
Right.
So they're holding up his newspaper and about to arrest him, and he's looking kind of smug and happy that this is getting the kind of attention that he wanted.
Again, we're talking about this special exhibition that's going on right now. It started already. It's running through April 15th. Again, at Nova Southeastern University, and it is looking at, really a lot of it is looking at the work and the life of Alexander Hamilton. It's called Alexander Hamilton, Immigrant, Patriot, Visionary. And again, running through April 15th, we're talking with Adam Levinson, curator of the exhibition. And also, you've been hearing from artist David Wells Roth, and he's going to be doing a talk on Sunday talking about some of his work, this colonial era paintings that he created some years back. His focus, though, is on Isaiah Thomas, again, a very important figure in that era. Real quickly, Adam, coming back to the exhibit and some of the collections, some of the things that people are going to get to look at, we think about historical exhibits, but how did you set this up so that people, because this is stuff that you have to take a little bit of time. You're not just going to walk by and look at it. You got to take some time to absorb this.
Excellent question, and I have to do some shout-outs if I could.
So yes.
This exhibit began with speeches I was giving and talks at the Sterling Road Library, and the Sterling Road Library is one of the most active library groups in the country, and as the Hamilton musical was playing, they needed speakers to explain it to them, so I was talking there. I've spoken to the Daughters of the American Revolution, the DOR, to the Hadassah, which is a fundraising organization. We've reached out to groups and found out what people want to know about Hamilton. So we were fortunate through the AHA Society, which is the Alexander Hamilton awareness society, and people call it the aha society. I call it the aha society. So what they've been doing, to your point earlier, is raising awareness about Hamilton, who had sort of fallen off the map for many years. Jefferson gets a lot of attention, and of the founding generation, many of them were Virginians, Madison and Monroe and Washington. They all become president, but Hamilton doesn't because he dies in 1804. So the aha society, because I have relations with them, and I would go to Trinity Church every year. They celebrate Hamilton's death. And they celebrate, they are in charge of the Hamilton Grange. If anyone wants to go up to 144th Street, I believe, in Upper Manhattan, that's one of Hamilton's houses where he wanted to retire one day. So the AHA Society, who does these events, was able, we were terrifically lucky, to secure for us a book. And I want to stress this to the readers and to the listeners. This book was Hamilton's actual legal text. And you're not going to know the name, most people, of the writer of this book. This is a humanist Enlightenment thinker that Hamilton repeatedly cites. He's one of the legal giants in the 1600s. His name is Hugo Grotius. And Hamilton cites this book for our musical listeners. He cites it in the essays, which were the Farmer Refuted essays in 1775. He cites this book in the Federalist Papers. He cites this book years later in opinions he writes to Washington. And most importantly, and I blog about this on statutesandstories.com, he cites this book in the Camillus essays. And people sort of shrug their heads, the Camillus essays? What are you talking about, Camillus House? Because we have a Camillus House. But these Camillus essays that Hamilton writes are 42 essays. Because this is a guy that picks up his pen when there is a crisis. He writes, and he doesn't stop.
He was a prolific writer.
He is nonstop. So in the Camillus essays, and we have newspapers with the Hamilton articles written, his essays, under his Camillus pseudonym in the exhibit.
Only because I'm running out of time real quickly. I wanted to get a sense from you. Look, we know so much about what he wrote about and what he did and the things that he created, but is there one thing that you could tell us that we don't talk about enough or know about Hamilton that you're going to learn at the exhibit?
So getting back to this Grotius book, which has Hamilton's signature in it, and this is his go-to book on international law. And Grotius is cited in the U.S. He's on the frieze of the U.S. Supreme Court and with the other lawgivers in American history, the Justinian and Moses and Hammurabi, the lawgivers of the history of law. So Grotius is cited there. He's also on the door in the gallery of the House of Representatives. So Hamilton cites Grotius. And what does he cite Grotius for? The representation of minority rights under law. And that's one of the things I would like to stress, that Hamilton was a manumissionist. He wanted to free slaves. He wanted to protect the loyalists. He cites it in cases that go to the courts to represent
Are people going to get to talk to you while you're there? Are you going to be there?
I will make an effort to be there every Sunday.
So Adam Levinson, curator of the exhibition at Nova Southeastern University, again, running through April 15th. If you want to know more about Alexander Hamilton, please go find Adam and just sit down and talk with him for a while. He's also, again, behind the historical blog Statues and Stories. Also, David Wells Roth, a contemporary painter. He's going to be doing a talk on Sunday at 2 o'clock. We've got more information about the entire event, all the events, on our website and also at WLRN Sundial. Gentlemen, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Still to come, an opera about the Mexican artist and feminist Frida. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, before there was the Me Too movement, there were a lot of women who fought for equality in society, and one of those was Mexican artist Frida. And her story is now a part of a big stage performance put on by Florida Grand Opera. It's the revival of the 1990s opera called Frida by American composer Robert Javier Rodriguez. The story follows the trajectory of Frida's life story and work as one of the most recognized Mexican figures of that era. It reflects on Mexican culture, music, decor, and dance. Now, the opera opened at the Miramar Cultural Center this past weekend and will have other performances at the Parker Playhouse in Fort Lauderdale and the Miami-Dade County Auditorium. You can see videos, by the way, and photos of last week's dress rehearsal at WLRN Sundial. Colombian lead soprano opera singer Catalina Cuervo performs the role of Frida Kahlo, and she talked to our associate producer Alejandra Martinez about becoming Frida on stage.
It all started here in Miami. We did a double bill of Maria de Buenos Aires, the opera by Astor Piazzolla, and an opera by Robert Javier Rodriguez, composer of Frida, called Tango. We did that double bill with Florida Grand Opera. So when we performed the opera, Maestro Robert Javier Rodriguez came to see the performance. And when we finished, he came and he introduced himself And he said, Cata, I composed an opera back in the 90s that was very successful. And it's called Frida and is based on the life of Frida Kahlo. And I think you are perfect for it. And then a little bit after, Michigan Opera Theater, about 6 months after, called me, hired me to do Frida because Robert Javier Rodriguez, the composer, recommended me.
Did Robert tell you why he thought you were so perfect for this role?
Personally, as a Catalina Cuervo, I am a very strong woman. I am Latina. But it was also because his composition was exactly for my type of voice. So he basically wanted to show Frida's bipolar personality and the use of her lower register, because Frida used to talk very low. They used to call her Ronca. She would like talk very, very low and very, very ronca, hoarse. So he wanted to portray that in the music. So there I will sing full lyrical phrases, very high for soprano, and then all of a sudden calm down to those very chesty notes and full phrases in the chest voice. Mm-hmm. And I have that capacity and I have that range in my voice. So he thought it was perfect for it.
What have been the challenges in having to play a real person, especially someone who you admire so much?
I will say the biggest challenge is being able to make Mexican people fall in love for me, this Colombian woman. So as a Colombian woman, when Frida was given to me, I wanted to make sure that the Mexican people would be happy with my performance, that they wouldn't feel like, why is this Colombiana doing Frida? It needs to be a Mexican woman. So every time I perform and every time I study and every time I do it, I'm always thinking, I hope they love me. I hope they accept me. And I hope I do something that they will be proud of.
The opera starts with Frida Kahlo as a teenager. It goes through her whole life. How much preparation did you have to do for this role?
Definitely months and months of it, and I still prepare for it. I've been doing it for 5 years now, starting with reading a lot of biographical books, everything I could get my hands on, watching movies, watching documentals, watching lots of videos. You will be amazed how much material is out there. One of the special things I have is that DIA, the Detroit Institute of Arts in Detroit, has this video footage of Frida and Diego doing the murals there in Detroit.
Diego's Frida's husband.
Yes, Diego Rivera's Frida's husband, the great muralist. Then I've also really strictly analyzed the way she paints, the way she talks.
There's a powerful aria in the opera about a moment in Frida's life. It's right after this horrible bus accident. This moment kind of started her artistic career. Talk to us a little bit about that point in the show.
In this moment, the rail of the bus passed through the front of her body towards the back and destroyed, went in through her vagina, came out through the end of the column in the back. She was like literally pierced with the handrail from side to side. Miraculously, a lot of her interns were not damaged, but her column was definitely damaged big time. They didn't expect for her to live.
But the aria, when you're performing it, you're saying death is dancing on my bed or around my bed, something like that.
So Frida always had this saying, as she called La Pelona. La Pelona is coming for me. La Pelona is death. And in the Mexican culture, La Pelona is the image of a woman, a bold woman that represents death. And then you mentioned something before in that aria, something beautiful that happens. This is the time where Frida really gets into the painting. She started painting her casts. And also, she says, there's a part where she says, Dear Alejandro, she's telling her first boyfriend, I stole some oil paints from my mother, and my father ordered this little easel so I could paint lying down in bed. So she starts painting at this moment in the opera.
And she starts her career as a painter.
Yes, yes.
I'm speaking with Catalina Cuervo. She's a Colombian-born soprano opera singer, and she's starring as Mexican artist Frida Kahlo in the opera Frida. The opera opened at the Miramar Culture Center this past weekend and will have other performances at the Parker Playhouse in Fort Lauderdale and the Miami-Dade County Auditorium. there's another scene. There's a scene that might speak to a lot of people in South Florida, especially the migrant community here. It's the one when Frida first arrives to the U.S. So she arrives in New York, and you have the curtain opens, and then you have all these socialites of New York. You know, Mrs. Ford, Mr. Ford, the Rockefellers, and the women are wearing pink, beautiful, silky dresses. And then Frida comes in with this Tijuana dress, the strongest Tijuana dress we have, which is with greens and yellows and red.
I am Mexico, and that's how they must see me. The Tijuana is perfect, the everyday dress of the forgotten people.
So after she has this scene where she is introduced to the socialites, she has a monologue, you know, and then she says, "My name is Frida Kahlo," which back in the time, she just said, you know, "I'm Mrs. Rivera," because, you know, Diego Rivera was a huge, one of the best painter in the world. And then she was nobody, let's say, in that moment. But they say, "And who is she with that dress in there?" So she says, "My name is Frida Kahlo. I'm also a painter, but not like Diego. Small things, nothing serious. He paints the big outside. I paint the secrets inside." Towards the end of the first half of the show, I wanted to talk to you about another scene. This one connects one of Frida Kahlo's famous self-portraits. It's like Frida's octopus hands coming out of her belly. Story behind that painting.
So Frida had something around 6 to 9 miscarriages. So she would get pregnant, but basically her uterus couldn't hold the baby in. I think this was the most horrific thing in her life. On top of everything, you know, like she was a survivor. All kinds of things happened to her. A million things. Polio when she was a kid, then the accident, then you know, her relationship with Diego was very difficult. Mm-hmm. Him cheating on her with her own sister was one of the things that really hurt her. But definitely the thing that Frida was hurt the most was with the inability to create babies and to have kids. Mm-hmm. She wanted to be a mother so bad.
To explain to us kind of what we see on stage, because, mm-hmm. you know, you bring this painting to life.
So Diego tells her, "I just had the miscarriage. You see all this blood represented with these red ribbons on the stage, and I am crying and touching it, the ribbons." And Diego says, "Put your struggles into the canvas and you'll feel better.
Why don't you paint something? It will help you pass the time."
So use this pain that you're feeling and throw it to the canvas. So I go, I grab all the ribbons, and I go to the canvas and throw the ribbons to the canvas. And that what that represents is really what she did, which was using the pain and her emotions and using all those difficult moments in her life and putting it on canvas to make art.
You know, you were telling me about all these moments that Frida had to go through, all these like obstacles in her life, and how they made her into the person she became. Why do you think she's such an important figure to the Latinx community?
You know, Latinas in general, we are strong women. We have to deal with so much. And that's what, you know, that's basically what Frida is. And that's why we sometimes can reflect on her. Because all of us also suffer in our own way. You know, we don't have to have a bus accident to have equal pain for other reasons. Being a survivor is what we strive for.
Catalina, you're in almost every scene, like 2.5 yes, hours, and you're in almost every scene.
All of them but one.
What kind of stamina did you have to build for this performance?
Oh, God. Yes, the most difficult thing about this opera is that. Now, what people don't see is that as soon as I go backstage between scenes, I have 40 seconds, 1 minute, 1 minute and 20 seconds between scenes. And in that time, I'm running like a crazy woman, okay? Me and the team, the fantastic team, we are making those quick changes, all of them in about a minute. I have 9 to 10 quick changes. We not only change the clothing, but we change hair, clothing, and makeup every time I come out. Plus drink water, plus rest a second, plus go in and out. What people don't realize is that not only the stamina that I have to have to be on stage, but it's the whole process. It's basically running for 3 hours.
And, you know, you live here in South Florida, and you perform this opera outside of Florida. In Detroit, what are you looking forward to the most, knowing that you're going to be performing this at home?
To tell you the truth, I've been dreaming of this for years, since we did it in Detroit. Last time I sang with Florida Grand Opera, long time ago. So I dreamt, obviously, to be back and sing with Florida Grand Opera. And when I did Frida with Detroit, I started messaging Florida Grand Opera and being like, you got to see this, because this is the one for Miami and South Florida.
Well, thank you so much, Catalina.
Thank you, Alejandra.
And that was WLRN Sundial Associate Producer Alejandra Martinez talking to opera singer Catalina Cuervo. Cuervo is starring as Frida Kahlo in the opera Frida, being presented by the Florida Grand Opera. The opera has performances at the Parker Playhouse in Fort Lauderdale and at the Miami-Dade County Auditorium. We have photos of the dress rehearsal from last week and info for upcoming shows on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Monday, March 18th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.